thank the organizers of the workshop for organizing the workshop so nicely. And I would also like to apologize for submitting the title of the talk pretty late. And I just have to apologize in advance in case the talk seems to be kind of incoherent. It's because it's here. So what I would like to tell you today is something about a quantum field theory with minimal lengths that I've worked on for quite a while. This talk is actually kind of an introduction for the next talk by Uli, who will probably say something more about the details. So the last time I gave that talk was last week, and it was about 10 minutes long. So I kind of extend this yesterday. And the second part of the talk is a bit of experimental. So in case I don't actually speak 90 minutes, then you might have to take it out of the break. So an interesting thing about my work on this model, you can already see from that first slide, is that the first paper I wrote in 2003, and then there's a gap. And then the follow-up papers were only written this year. There is a story with that that I would really like to tell you. In 2003, I was about to finish my PhD thesis, which had been about black holes in extra dimensions. And I kind of figured if I ever wanted to work on something that I'm really interested in, I would have to leave Frankfurt, where people are mostly working on nuclear physics. So I thought it would be a good idea to go somewhere to North America on a conference and give a talk and recruit impression. So I looked up some conferences and I found the SUSY conference, which looked very interesting. And well, I thought I should go there. The small problem with that was that I had never actually worked on supersymmetry. But they have a section that's called alternatives. So I thought alternatives I can do. And there were 6 weeks to go to the conference and 2 weeks to the deadline. So I scanned some notes that I had and I thought, well, interesting topic that I could finish by these 6 weeks was the question in how far it is possible to incorporate the notion of the minimal length into quantum field theory. The reason why I was interested in that was that it seems kind of to be of a common understanding that the Planck length is something like a minimal length, and that the Planck mass is something like a regulator in the ultraviolet, which is supposed to come out of the not yet known theory of quantum gravity. And I was just wondering if it's possible to set up quantum mechanics of quantum field theory such that this minimal length is already included in it. So I submitted a title and an abstract that was as vague as possible. And with 4 weeks to go, I started to scan some literature. Well, there was a fairly lot of work that had been done on this, most notably by Achim. And then there were some very early works by Uli and so on that had been investigations of Hawking radiation of black holes concerning the question how physical the blue shifted modes of the horizon actually are. And then in the early 90s and so on, there were lots of papers investigating transplantian signatures in the universe for inflation and so on and so on. The problem was that each of these papers started off from a different point and they all used slightly different framework and they didn't really fit together. So after 2 weeks, I was kind of frustrated and began to get nervous and I threw away all these papers. And I thought, well, I have to start from scratch and see that everything fits together. And that was what I did. So 2 days before I went to the conference, that work was, well, halfway finished. I went there, I gave the talk, and the SUSE conference 2003 was in Tucson, Arizona. I didn't know that then what I would spend the next 2 years there. One thing that I came across when I was working on this theory with minimal length is the problem of Lorentz transformation, which is kind of obvious if you think about it. If you have something like minimal length and you boost it, you do not want it to get smaller than minimal. So something has to be done about it. I worried about that a long time, almost a whole day, after which it turned out that whatever this modified Lorentz transformation is, in my calculations, it never actually appeared in the final results. So for my purposes, it was completely sufficient just to assume that this transformation exists. I didn't really need to know how it actually looks like. This was very convenient. And again, I searched some of the literature, and I found there are some real people working on that, like some Italian guys, and then there was this Portuguese guy with a completely unpronounceable name. And well, then they were the form of Lorentz transformation, and they looked ugly. So what I did was read just people thinking about that, and I put a note in their paper. And it was only last year in December when I was here that I kind of realized that this deformed special relativity had become kind of important during the years that I spent in Arizona. And I set up to figure out what is the relation to my modeling for minimal length and what are the differences. And so this is roughly what I would like to talk about today. So the existence of a minimal length scale is a very general expectation that one has from quantum gravity, because if one takes a particle with very high energy, one expects it to significantly disturb the space-time it propagates in, which leads to an additional uncertainty, which eventually should lead to something like a fundamental finite resolution of structures. Indications for that can be found in various approaches, string theory, loop gravity, non-commutative geometries, and so on and so on. The most convincing argument might actually be that there seems to be no approach that can go without something like a minimal length scale. The reason for that is essentially that the minimal length scale is needed as a regulator in the ultraviolet. As I said before, I have worked on models with large extra dimensions, and what's important about this is that in this case one can have a lowered Planck mass or a raised Planck length, which means that the effects of the minimal length would become important much sooner and could actually be observable for colliders. So this was kind of what I had in mind. What I wanted to do was actually computing cross-sections, make predictions for collider, stuff like that. Of course, I was also interested in the question of black hole production at the collider, what I had worked on before, like how far is this modified in the scenario with the minimal length. I mean, you would expect it to be modified, but how would that exactly work out? Okay, so what I started from was the question, how can I achieve something like a fundamentally finite resolution of space-time? So the reason why we build larger and larger colliders is that we need higher energies to go to smaller wavelength, and smaller wavelength allow us to resolve smaller and smaller structures. So what I started from was, I said, well, let's just modify the usually linear relation between wave vector and momentum such that no matter how high I make the energy of the particle, its wavelength can never get arbitrarily small. Or the wave vector has an upper. So this modified relation between the wave vector k and momentum is schematically shown in this picture. There are, of course, some constraints that one has on this relation. One is that in the small energy limit, you want to reproduce the usual linear behavior. It has to be an odd function, and it should asymptotically approach the inverse of the minimal length. So the exact choice of that function is an input that goes into the model. It's, of course, not completely known how it looks like, but from the requirements that you put in that function, you can already see that all choices for this function will look kind of equal. I mean, they will all start out linear here. They all have to asymptotically approach a constant value at large energies. So they will in general, deviate in this intermediate region where you can make something like a first-order approximation and parameterize your modifications in this parameter. So here is the modified relation between wave vector and momentum that can be expanded in the power series. And if you deal with that into quantum mechanics, then you find that the commutation relation between the momentum and the position operator is modified, and this results in a generalized uncertainty principle. If you make that first order approximation, it looks something like this, and here appears this expansion parameter. You see that the uncertainty increases again if you go to large energies that are comparable to the new fundamental scale. This also leads to a squeezed momentum space at high energies. In this case, it is more appropriate to take the high energy limit where the function becomes constant, and so the derivative drops to zero. And from the Jacobian that enters into the volume element, you see that at high energies, the measure in momentum, space gets essentially squeezed. I also want to point out that the model in the form that I use can, but it need not have a varying speed of light. And in all the examples that I show you later that I picked, actually there is no varying speed of light. It is possible within this kind of model, but it's not necessary. The reason is that a general relation of that kind must not necessarily modify this derivative. So, so for a massless particle, you would have something like that. And the most easiest way to see that this is actually possible is if you take same function on both sides. This will not modify the light curve. And it's this kind of function that I have chosen for the examples that I'll show you later. In most of the approaches from Diffrom special relativity, the function looks kind of different. You will look something like this, in which case you have something like the running scale. So this is also possible, but it must not be the case. Yes, this is to remind you that what I talked about earlier, that one can make two expansions that are useful for different purposes. There's the first order expansion that can tell you something about the first effects that you expect. And then there's the high energy limit where the important input is essentially that the function gets constant. Here you also see one of the choices that I like is the error function, which looks exactly like the curve that I showed you earlier. The tangent symbolicus is another choice that is kind of nice. One should keep in mind that this first order expansion is not an appropriate choice if you integrate over whole momentum space. Because then you have to go all the way up to infinity, and one would actually choose this expansion.
Excuse me, can you define what you mean by P and what you mean by K precisely?
Well, K is the wave vector and P is the momentum.
Those are words, but I mean in a scheme, in a dynamical scheme, what means P and what means K.
Well,
K is the eigenvalue. K is the eigenvalue of something.
Yeah.
And P is an operator.
Yes. Well, K can also be an operator. If you quantize, they will both be operators.
Both are operators, and there will be. So you're going to teach us what measurements are made to distinguish these.
Yeah, that's exactly the right question. You actually always have to ask, what is it that you actually measure? Do you measure a wavelength, like a geometrical quantity, like something fits into a box, or do you actually measure the energy of the particle? So you have to think about what you observe. So the K is, if you take a plane wave solution, then the K is the thing that appears at the exponential.
And so I think, the wavelength of a plane wave.
Yeah.
And P is the physical momentum you would ascribe to the wave.
Yes.
It ordinarily would be proportional to K, but is not.
No. Right. Yeah, that should also become clearer on this slide, actually. If you quantize this relation, then you replace the K with the partial derivative, and the momentum operator then becomes a higher derivative operator. And if that acts on a plane wave, it will not only just take down the K from the exponent, but it will reproduce the whole power series in which you have expanded it. From these ansatz you can go on and derive the equation of motions and the usual way that you do that, like the Clairaut equation from quantizing the mass shell condition. And these are always the newly defined momentum operators that enter here, which will have higher order derivatives. The same goes for the Dirac equation, where you have to contract the gamma matrices, and then you can go on to quantum field theory by looking at the commutation relations.
Why is this different from a standard higher derivative fraction? How is it?
The action?
Yeah, I mean, I think that P is a canonical conjugate to X dot. A K is simply the eigenvalue on the translations, and I will get the fact of these types of relations.
Right, it's not. It looks like a higher derivative action, just what is transformed is the Lorentz invariance, the way it works. You will see it later on when I show the Lagrangian, actually.
Just as a somewhat related question, so the formalism or the paradigm seems designed so that the traditional relationships for Klein, Gordon, and Dirac look the same in P space, but
right.
It's the derivative operations
yep.
that.
That's exactly.
That's basically the way
you proceed. P space, everything looks the same, and the momenta and the energy also are the quantities that have the standard Lorentz transformation. It's just the quantity K that is modified, and that has other properties.
And these commutation relations are related to the Wronskian of the deformed Klein-Gordon equation?
Well, they should, yeah.
So that's how you get them? That is, normally you appeal to the commutator of phi and E0 phi, and then you get commutation relations between annihilation and creation operators. And that has to do with the value of the Wronskian, which is, and now you have a deformed Klein-Gordon equation. You have F of D. And so these how are these commutation relations with the weight dp dk related to the deformed Reinhardt equation. That's how
does it differ from normal
quantum mechanics where you get the commutation relation in the study of the Bunch scheme?
I'm pretty sure one can also derive this relation from this approach, but this was actually not how I did it, so I will need to think about it.
Sorry, I think the point you want to make is that in principle, when you find a field theory, in order to make sure that the computation relation is folded all the time, you go through the calculation and you use the fact that the Wronskian is conservative.
Yes.
But you can show that generally all commutation relations, no matter what you write down, will be conserved as long as the time evolution is unitary.
So as long as the time evolution
as long as the time
is
evolution
unitary.
Yes. So basically, as long as you ensure Hamiltonian is self-adjoint,
that's okay. That's going to be so it's unitarity which is assumed to be the stability requirement for this formalism to.
Yeah. Actually, it's a one-line proof to show that unitarity.
Okay, now since it was asked before about the observables, I will always be working in momentum space because eventually what I want to compute is like the energy spectrum in a scattering experiment or something. So I always aim to express everything in momentum space. And you can, of course, expand your field that you are interested in K space as well as in momentum space, but I will always try to do it in momentum space because this is what I will eventually be interested in. So, since this has been pointed out by several referees, this is, of course, just merely rewriting where the Jacobian appears here. And we should keep in mind that also this first line is already modified from the standard expression because integration in K-space is finite. I mean, this is the assumption of the whole setup that K does not go to infinity. So in the lower line, the integration rounds up to infinity, but then you have this additional Jacobian factor. Again, the momenta have the usual properties. They are conserved in the usual sense, they transform in the usual sense. And the final results are expressed in terms of these momentum variables. It is just that in intermediate steps, the notion of this wavelength can become important. The reason for this is that what I was aiming to do is to find something like an effective description for effects of quantum gravity, and these you would expect to become important in a region where curvature is very strong. That is, in a region where you have a large amount of energy in a very small space-time region, like you can, for example, produce in a scattering experiment. So what you need is large S and a small impact parameter to make these effects become important, and in this intermediate region where as a critically free particles meet, this modified relation between wave vector and momentum will become important. And this is a rough sketch how I think about it. One has the asymptotically free particles that go in and out into the scattering region, and in this intermediate region at a large center of mass energy and small impact parameter, large and small orbits occurring relative to the Planck scale, wherever that might be, there will be non-negligible effects of the background where the particle propagates in, and this yields to this modification of the dispersion relation. And I mean the dispersion relation is nothing else but the propagator of this exchange particle. And this is where the modification comes in.
But in fact, that a kernel, that scattering kernel may have an imaginary part, and the particles just get absorbed into some unknown world that we don't know about, because that would not be in the formalism.
Yes, right. This is excluded. There's no world.
So that's associated with the unitarity, with the unitarity comment. We can't lose them.
In this case, yes.
Yes, okay, so this is something that I only stumbled across recently. That is, one can re-express what I just told you in terms of an energy-dependent metric, and I kind of like this description. That is why I would like to briefly tell you about this. The reason is that even on a classical level, if you can no longer neglect the back reaction of a particle in the space-time, then you would expect the space-time to actually become energy-dependent, because the particle itself carries energy. And on a quantum level, one actually expects this dependent to be the dominant input. Since it's not so easily possible to solve this back reaction problem, it's hard to say how exactly this relation looks like. And I would actually doubt that on a classical level it would lead to something like a minimal length, because then we wouldn't need quantum gravity. But this is just a motivation for why one would expect the background to actually depend on the energy of the particle. And one can see rather easily that one can re-express this general relation between wave vector and momentum in terms of an energy-dependent metric.
Isn't this the usual statement that you can't trust general relativity and energies approximating the Planck scale?
Yes.
I would like to come back to the scattering matrix.
What
happens when the fields are so high that the k's, which are related to them, are such that the sum of the two k's is higher than your cutoff, because you have a minimal length?
Yeah.
So how do you think about momentum conservation in the way that you did it?
Momentum is conserved in the usual way, because it's only properly defined for the asymptotic particles. And the wave vector, since it has modified transformation under the Lorentz group, does not add linearly. So
the formalism will the Klein-Gordon equation containing an interaction term, the formalism automatically would take care of the momentum conservation. I say you take your Klein-Gordon equation, and then you have an interaction, so you have a higher order effect, it's a nonlinear term, and so on.
And
you do the formalism, and everything is okay. You can get along with the commutation relations, and you can think about momentum conservation.
Yes.
Asymptotic momentum conservation.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the Lagrangian. Again, as it was noticed before, what essentially does it, one replaces the usual momentum operator with this higher derivative operator, and then bridges it between the field and the usual way. And what you see in this shaded gray over here is always the same equation with the energy-dependent metric. The coupling to the gauge fields can be done in the usual way by replacing the partial derivative with the gauge covariant derivative. And well, you see that this quantity has all the properties that you would want to have, like this invariant on the gauge transformations and stuff like that. So what you can do is you can take your Lagrangian that you have now and make an expansion in that series, and you find that, of course, that to first order, the interaction vertex is just the standard one. And in this approximation, the most important contributions come from the modification of the propagator. So this is the dispersion relation. for the virtual particle. I should point out again that it is only the Sturm relation for the virtual particle that is modified, because the free particles do not experience any strong curvature effect or something like that. They do not experience them by definition because the interaction is only shut off if they come into the strong curvature region. And this is where everything happens. Yes, what one has to keep in mind if one is working with this higher order derivative Lagrangian is that the Euler-Lagrange formula can be kind of nasty if one wants to derive the equation of motions, because one has to keep track of all these derivatives that appear there. And since the function becomes asymptotically constant, it is fairly obvious that it actually has to include an infinite amount of higher order derivatives. But it cannot be a polynomial, otherwise it wouldn't be constant.
Are there any special considerations for non-abelian fields?
I don't think so, even though I actually only have computed examples in QVD. So one has to make sure that despite all these higher order derivatives, one still gets the right equation of motions, like the one that one started from. When I wrote the first paper, I did that rather naively, I'm afraid, and I was just basically thinking whether the thing that is sandwiched between the fields is the propagator. It was only later that it was pointed out to me that one has to make sure that this actually works with the Euler-Lagrange formalism. And what one needs for this is that one has to shift these derivatives from the one side to the other side, and then there appears some total derivatives that one can drop because they only make a surface term or something. But luckily, it can actually be shown, and the details of this are in one of the papers, it's not as relevant, that one can actually do that also for this higher order derivative operator. And that the remainder is just a total derivative that can be dropped. And this works.
As long as the derivative is commutative, it's obvious.
It also depends on the order of the derivatives. Because otherwise, you mess up this minus sign. And this works because the function is odd. If it would have mixed orders of derivations, then it wouldn't work out to be that.
One more question about whether the formal setup in higher dimensions than one, the commutators of p's with the axis with the different spatial indices, how do they work out?
Well, they work out in the usual way. It's like if that factorizes.
It's a legitimate postulate to delta ij.
Yeah.
You see, what I have in mind in that question is, for example, if I have a model Hamiltonian and like in a Landau diamagnetism, where I have a magnetic field on the system next to the field, and that upsets usual commutation relations. So Px and Y don't commute if the field is in the Z direction.
Yeah.
And then
I have not distinguished.
And that's associated with minimal length because of the modes are localized modes with the what's called the diamagnetic radius, and you can't probe lengths with those modes, the arbitrary small distances. And this is a related problem to the relativistic problem of the accelerated observer, where the circles are not put into a hyperbole, mm-hmm. and then you want to probe at the distances very close to the light cone. So that problem is a severe problem in some cases, and one has to watch out for that if one wants a generally non-localized formalism. I'm just saying. It's some experience I had in that. I couldn't solve that problem.
Yes. I would be worried about that if I had taken an even more general commutation relation, like in the case where you also have terms that depend on x squared. So the one that I started from is actually not the most general one. But in this case, since everything respects rotational invariance, I think that works out. And I think Ulrich will have something to say about the magnetic fields, don't you? Yes.
Yeah. Are you saying you're just using the same dispersion relation for each dimension separately?
What do you mean with separately? I didn't say that, but I've always assumed that this is so whenever there's a P, it's actually the absolute value of P.
So, is the simple way of understanding this that all the Feynman rules in P space look just like they ordinarily would, and the only difference is the integration measure gets this function of P? Is that a simple way of doing it,
yes.
Or do the
Yes.
Okay, so everything is identical in P space except when I integrate over P, I've got that suppression factor from that thing.
Yes, in this expansion where I took only the first interaction term in the latter region. Yes?
I have a simple question about the current of motion
I sandwiched the equation of motion between the fields. Yes, then you have to make sure that you actually get it back if you make the Euler-Lagrange formula. So what I actually started with the equation of motion, as you said earlier, and then I was looking for the Lagrangian. So this was what you just said. You replace the measure in momentum space. In some cases, we will see later, it's of course necessary to make a weak rotation then. One keeps the vertices in this approximation. Energy momentum conservation is still the usual one because what conserved is are the asymptotically in and outgoing energies of the particles. So the I is initial and F is final. Yes. And again, for the asymptotically in and outgoing field, there is the usual translation invariance, and the P acts as the generator of translations, and the P's transform under the usual Lorentz transformation.
So, can you explain why it is the physical momentum which is conserved, since you said that it is K?
This is the assumption. This is the assumption.
But you said that you have translation invariance.
For the whole box,
I would say that the K are automatically conserved by delta field.
Well, yes, they are conserved, but they that depends on what you mean conserved. If you
not linearly.
Yes.
If by delta theorem, if
you are of course right. But if you just take one free particle, then the one quantity is concerned, and then the other quantity is also concerned.
No, in the interacting theory.
Yeah, but you have to. These quantities do not add linearly. So then, what is the quantity that you actually want to conserve? Just some of all.
From Luther theorem, what do you learn? With the fact that your action will be invariant under. Rigid translation. You should have a certain quantity which is conserved.
Yeah, that's what
I wanted. Do you think you will? It's a spatial.
At infinity,
no, the actual
form is
the computing. The charge. The interaction. You just compute what are the conserve charge associated with budget translation? You got an answer. And I would have thought it would be the K more than the P.
Well, in the as a topic region, the P is identical.
No, I said conjunction.
Isn't it true that your this might be wrong because I came in late, but your Feynman rules are not coming from a fixed action?
What do you mean with a fixed action?
You're not just, the theory is not derived from an action.
No.
The interactive.
No, I started the other way around. Like, I started with the equation of motion.
So the free part is coming from an action, but it looks like the interactive part is not.
Yeah, so this is only, this is this approximation. Yes, then there's of course something that you would wonder about, that is what happens to the equal time commutation relations. And this is something that has been termed the locality bound in the paper by Giddings and Lippert, in which they have just proposed that the equal time commutation relation might be non-zero outside for non-vanishing special separations. And this is actually something that you would expect also in this theory. And starting from the modified computation relation for the emulation and creation operators, you can actually just compute how this thing looks like. And you find, yes, it does not vanish. This is, of course, what you would expect if you go close to the minimal length, then this commutator cannot vanish anymore. The reason why this is not vanished is actually closely related to the question of localized states. So since the integration in K space does not actually go to infinity, this is not really a Fourier transformation. And so in position space, where I have never worked in so far, you cannot actually localize your particles arbitrarily good, but you get maximally localized states. And this is essentially also the reason why this does not work out to be exactly a Fourier transformation, in which case this would just be delta function that would produce the usual result. So you have this additional factor here that comes in from the Jacobian. So here I have again chosen a specific form for this function, which was the error function. And then you see that in case these things get the separation gets close to the minimal length, then this factor will become wrong. This does not vanish. Whereas in well, in the large system, this gives essentially zero. Yes, then, of course, the reason why I was doing this exercise was that I was hoping the minimal length would act as a regulator in the ultraviolet. And this becomes especially important if you are working in a theory with extra dimensions, because if you have additional dimensions, then loop integrations will generally be infinite. And this is usually cured by introducing some kind of an ad hoc regulator. For example, you can just use a hard cutoff. And if you do that, then you find that such a loop integral, as is depicted here for a particle that can actually enter the extra dimensions, will have a power law running with the power depending on the number of extra dimensions, and the lambda is the cutoff in the ultraviolet. Now, it's kind of obvious if you do that within the framework that I was just talking about, that you get this additional Jacobian factor, which can help you to regularize this integral. And the nice thing is, well, as I mentioned, you don't really need that because you know how to regularize your integrals. But in higher dimensions, this becomes kind of important. And of course, you would expect the result to depend on the regulator. Yes, so I have been asked to include some technical details on the model, and I thought, oh, great, technical details, and then I printed my own papers, and I was really impressed, and then I was wondering who wrote this paper. So, well, what you do if you compute something like, for example, the running coupling, is that you look at all these higher order contributions to the one particle irreducible, well, you decompose your full propagator into this one particle irreducible contributions, and then you can formally add them up. And well, you can do exactly the same thing within the model with the minimal X, since you have all the final moods. And what you would expect is that you cannot resolve these structures arbitrarily good, so this these contributions should kind of dump out at high energies. And this is how it looks like in detail. So here is the usual factor from the vertex, and here's this additional Jacobian. And after recrotation, well, you can just compute it. The nice thing about the error function, if you choose that, is that you can actually analytically solve the integrals. The details are not so really important. What is nice about this is that in the case without extra dimension, and for choosing the error function, you actually reproduce the Schwinger formalism, and you can see that this will just give the standard result. So in, if V is non-zero, then this gives you a result for the running of the coupling, and this is how it looks like. Just to give you an impression that it actually works. So the dotted lines are resulted from a hard cutoff, and the solid lines are resulted from the computation that I just showed you. So qualitatively, this is the same. The important difference is that in the case with the minimal length, you actually have a physical identification for your regulator.
So what are the different colors here?
The different colors, oh well, these are the different gauge groups.
Oh, QCD and...
Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's a very nice question. So are you trusting your theory all the way to your minimal length? Or are you saying I'm working at much lower energy and just
all the way to the
direction?
You mean all the way to the that's a question you can always ask if you look at the gauge groups. But yes, in this case.
No, but it was more a general question, because I would worry about things like when generically you'll have extra poles in your propagator.
Since you don't know what the relation between K and P is, right, and you're granted as a power law expansion, you can start, the moment you start thinking that the scale of U, you start doing an infinite amount of measurements to determine every single coefficient in that power series.
Right.
So this is
but
the usual
yeah,
problem
just
in
the very high energy limit, then you can basically forget about all the intermediate contribution because it will just automatically get constant. And the details of the result actually do not depend on exactly what happens in between.
Asymptotically.
Yes, in the
so
very
you're
high.
So you're assuming energy. Some specific point for your plot.
Yes.
Then the problem arises in the. You assume that the function asymptotes to a constant.
Yes.
So the meaning of those three curves at one point, I mean, did you engineer that? Or, I mean, because that's not necessarily guaranteed anymore when you introduce these extra.
Yes, there's a very funny story about that. So the paper with the cutoff is from Dinas, Dulas, and Gagata. And if you look at their plots, they have this huge dots where the curves are supposed to be. And if you take the function and you make the curves without the dots, you see that the curves actually do not really meet in one point.
Yeah.
There's a reason why this point is so fat. So,
I mean, that's a highly, especially when it's non-linear, that's a highly specialized situation.
Yes. Yes, and I have to admit that actually one can, of course, for all these unification scenarios, you can like ask 1 million more questions. I mean, you would, for example, expect that there appear additional particles that you would have to include into the running of the coupling and so on, and this would spoil up the point where these curves meet, or maybe they would no longer meet in exactly one point and so on.
I would just expect if I modify QED, QCD, yeah, and so on, which I guess, to address my earlier question, means you have done it for non-Abelian fields, or else you couldn't do the calculation.
Yeah, well, in this case, if you do the calculation, the only thing that enters are actually the beta coefficients that count the numbers of particles.
But anyway, I would have expected the curves, you know, two of them cross in one place and another in another, and get some huge triangle.
So the details of this running are actually kind of irrelevant. It's just that I made them to show that it actually regularized the integrals
And to follow up on the Rob's question, basically, did you fill in with the initial conditions of the running so that
it would be
uniform?
No, the initial conditions are.
Yeah, but something must have been fiddled with for them to do that. Right. So what was fiddled with?
Especially with lots of supersymmetry, they should not at all.
No, this is minimal supersymmetry, essentially.
Oh,
this is supersymmetric.
I'm sorry, I didn't. Yes, of course. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. Yeah, I'm sorry about it. So in the case without extra dimension, they need approximately this one.
Yeah, Susie. Okay, I see.
Yes. But it is also, if you take this minimal supersymmetric extension in the higher dimensional case and you make this power law running, then you, since you accelerate the running, this slight mismatch that you still have becomes kind of enlarged if you put it to smaller energies.
But this minimal length doesn't mess up supersymmetry.
Right,
so that would make, so supersymmetry would, I mean, it might enlarge the point, but I can see why they might need that, okay.
Can I comment, I'm still confused about the question. So, your propagator, you assume, doesn't have extra poles?
No.
It doesn't, so it's an analytic function. Because typically, if I modify a propagator by hand, by adding people or whatever, then I either get new poles or.
Because it's a pulse. This is the important part, it has to be counted as a pulse. Well, you could say it has a pole at infinity.
So, in your case, you're saying this is some. Yeah, you don't have. It's an analytic. But then there are problems with that as well. So when you have analytic, if I by hand modify a propagator with some analytic e to the minus p squared, let's say, then the problem there is you can show it's a causal. I mean, maybe I'm missing the point. There's a lot of pathologies with changing propagators.
Yeah, with the causality,
Well, let me ask another question. Does your equation motion have infinite number of time derivatives?
In the generic case, yes.
Because then, in that case, if you're saying I trust my theory all the way to the minimal length, then, for example, I'm just making a point, but if you have infinite number of time derivatives, you don't have a well-defined initial value point.
Oh, yes, in the initial value.
By any solution, one to a finite time interval, and so forth.
Yeah, you mean if you have an infinite number of derivatives, then you need an infinite amount of conditions.
Yeah. And it's more than that. You can't even specify the initial data arbitrarily. You need an infinite number of initial data. But how do you end up with infinite amount of time? I mean, in space, for sure, but how do you get more than two time derivatives?
How do I get them? I mean, this is the most general situation. It depends on what you actually enter.
But she said rotationally invariant, space-time. You see, you have the same relation between a good and good. You have the same relation between energy and the wavelength.
So, well, you do not need to have that, but in the most general case, you could have it. This is what I was trying to say.
It wouldn't help the Justin to go to the mainland and do the representation of each of the propagators and also modify a little bit when you cut it off by changing the directly representation, and then you can use the more standard law.
Well, that's right. So, there's...
Also, instead of working with P, you work with S and P. I mean, I don't know.
Well, there's the cable and the non-representation. I mean, there's a comment in Weinberg, right, that says that that's why you can't have a propagator that falls up faster than 1 over p squared, and that's because otherwise you violate the density, the spectral density is divided into the spectral density has to be propagated. You can rephrase it. But anyway, I didn't want
to. Okay, so since you have the Feynman rules, you can of course compute like the cross sections for 2-2 particle processes, something like this. This is just how it looks like. You have the usual conservation of energy momentum, then again there enters this Jacobian from the modified measure in momentum space. Yeah, and in this case, for 2-2 particle process, it turns out that in the end, this the relation between the total cross sections takes a very simple form, which looks like this. I will show you a plot about this later. It was a very nice result. This holds for all 2-2 particle processes. And you see from this the two most important inputs that go into this modification. The one is that to reach the same effect that you would have reached before for an energy that belongs to a certain wavelength, you now need to go to higher energies. This is the one effect. This is the first thing. And then the second thing is the modified measure of the phase space. Okay, now this is the relation to special relativity. I already said that before. There is a one-to-one correspondence between this function k of p and the deformation of the Lorentz invariance. The reason is that by assumption, the momentum transforms under the usual Lorentz transformation. So if you know the relation between the wavelength and momentum, and you know how the one quantity transforms, then you know how the other quantity transforms. And you can also do that the other way around. If you know the deformation of the Lorentz transformation, and you assume that the momentum transforms under the usual transformation, then you can get the relation between wavelength and momentum by boosting in and out of the rest thing. Yeah, this is an example for such a deformed Lorentz transformation. This is taken from this paper. Also, these theories with the constant relativity are not unique, so they come in different versions which are specified by this additional operator that is put around the usual generator. So it is important to note is that the Lorentz algebra actually remains unmodified, but its action on momentum space is modified in this form, and this is just an example for such a modification. The Lorentz transformation then actually looks like this. This is an example which actually has a varying speed of light. So the P0 is the energy. And these transformations have the property that they leave the inverse of the minimal length invariant. Yeah, so now these are the differences between the deformed special relativity and my approach. So in a deformed structural relativity, one starts by asking for a transformation that has, besides the speed of light, a second invariant that is this minimal length. And this transformation applies to all observers. If you apply that to like your propagating particles, then this means that also the free particles will transform under this deformed Lorentz transformation. What is not clear to me in this case is if this is supposed to be caused by quantum gravity, then one sets the scale for this effect, because if you have only one particle, what is the energy scale that makes this deformation come important? This is just, it's just not clear to me. So in my model, I thought about it in a completely different way. That was that these effects would only become important if you get too much energy together in a very small region of space-time, and you cause a strong curvature. And then it is the strength of the gravitational effects that sets the scale for the importance of this effect. And this is also the reason why free particles do not experience any of these effects. And eventually this condenses down in the modification of the propagator. There is an additional problem if you have something like a varying speed of light. Say the speed of light can actually go to infinity for energies that reach the Planck energy. If you have particles that can travel with an infinite speed, then you have kind of defined something like slices of equal time. And this distinguishes the reference frame. So I don't really know what to do with that. The approach from deformed structural relativity has several problems. The one is called the soccer ball problem. That is, if you assume that there is something like a maximum energy, not a lower value for the wave length, then you kind of have to get rid of it if you go to large objects, like, for example, a soccer ball, because the Planck mass is not actually so large. And we would still like to be able to bind together objects to masses that are higher than the Planck mass. So you kind of have to figure out how you get rid of this modified addition norm. So this is one of the problems. In the approach that I just talked about, this is not a problem, because if you put together objects like in an atom or something, they will never be in a region where effects of quantum gravity are actually strong, and you do not expect any modifications from that. The other question that is actually related to this is the question which quantity is conserved. There has been very much progress in the DSR approach, but apparently since the modification applies also for the momentum, these do not add linearly, and then you really have to ask yourself, well, which is the quantity that I want to conserve? Is it this one, or is it that one? And this again is not a problem in this approach, because the physical momenta are conserved in the usual way. This on the other hand also means that the predictions that you can make from my model are kind of less spectacular in several regards. For example, in theories with the deformed special relativity, it has been predicted that there might be a modification of the GZK cutoff. And this cannot happen in this approach for the simple reason that the pi r production that is supposed to make the GZK cutoff happens at the center of mass energy that is significantly below the Planck energy. And one has observed this process on Earth in a level of neutrality. And in my approach, the only relevant quantity that goes into the computation of the cross section is the center of mass energy. And it doesn't matter in which reference frame you make that, the cross section will stay the same. So this is the simple reason why in this approach there is no modification of the GCK cutoff, because the center of mass energy is a Lorentz scalar.
Simply because I missed the beginning of the talk, but so your modification of the metric in the propagator was set up in the center of mass time of any given Feynman diagram? Or was it fixed prior to a priori? That is there a fixed Lorentz frame in which the dispersion relation is defined?
Well,
the
dispersion relation, like the scalar, is very
Your k-dependent metric?
Yes.
Is k-dependent in the Lorentz violating way, right?
What do you mean with violating?
Well, the way it depends on k is not Lorentz invariant. No?
I'm not sure what you actually mean with Lorentz invariance. You mean it changes if you make a Lorentz transformation? Yes, because it's not a scalar.
No, but does it depend on, is it the same for k mu, for all cases that k mu is fixed?
You mean the contraction?
Yeah. G mu of k, right, that's what we're looking at. Is that function of k the same for all k's related by a Lorentz transformation?
No.
Right. So
I wouldn't expect that.
Right. So there's a fixed Lorentz frame in your
if you specify your g, yes.
Right. So.
But
so
it transforms in a specific way.
Right, but it seems, therefore, that what you just said about GZK is not correct, because if you have to make a Lorentz boost to get to the center of mass frame of the collision, then the form of the fact that your propagator is not Lorentz invariant for the internal lines will come into play.
No, it is Lorentz invariant. It just does not transform under the usual Lorentz.
I'm not so sure I understand. So are you saying that all inertial observers do see the same physics? Or do they?
Yes.
They all see the same physics?
Yes. They all experience something like a minimal length scale.
And it's the same scale for all inertial observers?
Yes. But the question is kind of, what do you mean with they see it?
But
so to see it there, you have to
make it. It's a Lorentz algebra that she tries to preserve, as far as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong. But then you have the momentum, the translation part too, and usually the momentum transfer linearly under the Lorentz transformations.
Well,
now she tries to do a theory where you keep the Lorentz transformations, so you keep all rotations and boosts, but the eigenvalues under translation, the wave factor, are now in a non-linear representation.
That has to be right. You have two invariant quantities. That's why this is sometimes called doubly special.
Is that roughly correct?
Yeah.
But concretely, does that mean that if I build an experiment and run it to get some results, now I take my machine in a rough air time, travel very fast as compared to my brain before, I perform the same experiment, I get the same.
Yes.
In that concrete way, they still have.
Yes.
But you're puzzling your picture because you begin with asymptotic momenta, a permissible transfer, you think that the particles propagate with a wavelength which is a permissible, a larger than the graininess. But each particle, okay, is permitted. But if you have them to collide, you get a total momentum, which is enough. So when you begin to feel the graininess, and then you say that they come out again, And you can get a formalism that concerns that momentum in spite of the fact that they get mixed up with the medium. That makes them.
There is the additional assumption that there is no loss.
The minimal wavelength.
That there is no additional loss in the
so it's a formalism which is designed to confront that problem. But whether it's right or not is another question.
Yes, that is of course. The only relevant quantity that sets the scale for these effects are Lorentz invariant quantities, and they remain Lorentz invariant. If you express them like the center of mass energy, you can express them in terms of the momentum, or you can replace the momentum in terms of the wave vector. But it still remains a scalar if you appropriately transform the quantities that you put in. It remains a scalar, that's the point. No matter in which respect you are.
I'm just wondering, if I actually do an experiment, and then I do a large transformation in the sense that I go into a boosted frame.
Yeah.
But what I do is linear in the wave factor. I would think so that it's linear in the wave factor, right? It just rotates.
But it's not.
No,
that's the thing. So.
Yeah.
Okay. So Lorentz transformations don't relate observers at constant velocities, but it's something.
But there would be conserved quantities called P that would be okay after this.
Might be best to save the topic discussion of DSR until coffee break. We've got a few minutes left.
Okay, so these are some applications that you can look at with the model. I think Ulrich will say more about that. You can, of course, look at quantum mechanics like energy level in the hydrogen atom, where the German magnetic moment of the muon, something like that. Then I mentioned that in theories with a variable speed of light, this gives you additional observables.
Cool.
Oh, yes. I said that this talk's probably equally surprising for me than it is for you. Yes, so this is a very quick summary about theories with extra dimensions. I basically just wanted to say that in this case, gravity becomes stronger at small distances, and it becomes stronger in such a way that it will be possible to produce gravitons and black holes already at the LHC. This is a rough schematic picture of that, and of course these black holes evaporate. Like in a Hawking process, where one doesn't really know the latest stages, but one thinks one knows fairly well what happens at the Hawking phase. And the reason why I'm telling that is that, of course, you would expect that to be modified in a theory with minimal length. The reason is that it is now more difficult to squeeze in your particles into a very small region of space-time because they have this additional uncertainty, so it should be more difficult to make a black hole. And you would also expect there to be some kind of modification for the evaporation. Yes, this is to remind me that there's always positive interest in the production of black holes. Like every 3 or 4 months, I receive an email by someone who's very concerned that the Earth will be swallowed by a black hole if they turn on the LHC. And yeah, you see the effects. Okay, so I was kind of interested to see whether the minimal lengths would work out to avoid black hole production at the LHC. And this is the outcome of the investigation of the total black hole cross-section at the LHC in a PV collision with and without the generalized uncertainty. And one sees that it becomes more difficult, but it's not gone. So for the LHC, the suppression is about a factor of 5. And this is the part that I was talking about earlier. This shows the ratio of the total cross section for 2-to-2 particle process. And well, you see that, of course, the region where the deviation starts is comparable to the new fundamental scale. So the constraints that you can get from the existing data on something like the minimal length scale is comparable to the constraints that you get on the models with from the models with large extra dimensions. And there has been lots of investigation also, especially recently, about the evaporation properties of black holes within the context of the generalized uncertainty, and also corrections for entropy and stuff like that, what people are interested in. And something that I'm especially interested in is what kind of a modifications would that give for thermodynamics, and this is something Ulrich will tell you a bit about. You would kind of expect, if you try to push your particles very densely together, when they have a very high energy, then this additional uncertainty that the particles have should become hot. So in the high temperature region, it should become more difficult to squeeze the particles tightly together. But this is, of course, very hand-waving. I would like to see an equation for it. And then, of course, eventually, it's an important question to ask whether one could derive some kind of this modified dispersion relation from some kind of a new field approximation. So now I have a slight detour that will take about 5 minutes, which is work in progress. If you give me that 5 minutes, that's something that I would like to tell you briefly about, because it kind of relates to the topic of the workshop. And it's a work that I have begun with Stefan Hofmann, who is not here. He's apparently still at the Memphis. And this is a work that has originally been done by Keith and Mike like 3 years ago. And I learned about it because I was sharing a room with Mike, who is Keith's postdoc. But they became kind of frustrated after 2 years working on it because nobody cited it. And this is very sad because I really like the idea. So this is a very rough outline. It's not my work, so I'm afraid I can't actually tell you that much about it. The idea is kind of, you can do finite temperature field theory by compactifying a timeline coordinate to a radius that is inverse to the temperature in the finite way. And if you put on top of that some kind of a T-duality for this radius, this gives you something like a dual temperature. And you would expect your quantities to have some kind of this dual behavior. The problem is, if you look at the standard thermodynamics, it actually does not have this invariance. And the question is it possible to modify thermodynamics in such a way that it preserves this thermodynamic duality? And the answer is yes, you can do that. The reason why that goes wrong, even if you start up with some potentials that have this duality, it is this derivative with respect to the temperature that spoils the duality for other quantities, like, for example, the entropy or specific heat or something. So what one has to do is one has to modify this derivative to something like a covariant derivative which respects the symmetry. And this gives you a modification of thermodynamics which respects the duality and which leads to deviations from the standard thermodynamic approach at very high temperature.
This is particle thermodynamics. It's particle thermodynamics, as opposed to string thermodynamics.
Well, I haven't said anything about the ensemble I'm talking about. This is a very general consideration so far. It's just about the transformation behavior of the quantities. Then eventually you would have to start with some potential from a concrete theory. And this is exactly what I would like to do, because that was not been done in the paper. They have just outlined how you would have to modify the standard thermodynamics in such a way that it preserves this duality. And what I would like to see is, isn't it possible to just actually take some ensemble and see what this modification looked like at high energy? Like, wouldn't you expect that to become a problem in your universe?
Excuse me, what does temperature mean? You begin with a relativistic action, and then you want to do thermodynamics with it. And non-relativistically, we know what to do, namely, that we associate a coefficient function with the action using imaginary time, and you have the periodicity in imaginary time.
Okay.
Now I'm asking, you want to do this in a relativistic fashion. But what is the definition of temperature? Namely, I know what temperature means in my risk frame. I'm asking you how to make this relativistically sensible. I don't know the answer. I think it's good to your question.
Yeah, actually, I haven't thought about the details. That was the point that I wanted to make. That
it's a puzzle.
This is a good approach in which one.
You just can't do anything. I mean, there must be a way, but I don't know what the answer is.
So what I essentially try to say is that this is an interesting approach in which I think one can examine modifications of thermodynamics at very high temperatures with potential implications for our universe and so on. And just
one comment, the same kind of question has been looked at with modified dispersion relations, not modified interaction in the way that you're looking at.
That was the reason why I wanted to look into it, to see whether that goes along, whether there are differences, perhaps the equation of state, stuff like that. I found it very sad that they suddenly stopped working on that just because, well, it's not really string theory, and the people didn't really know what to do with it. And, okay, that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, I just have one other. About 15 years ago, Moffat and Woodard and Evans formulated a quantum field theory that had the same kind of exponential momentum cutoff that you're using in the Feynman diagram. So how does your model differ from what they were doing?
That's hard to say because I didn't know what that.
Yeah, it was in FizzRev, early 90s in FizzRev. You might want to talk to John about it, because all the stuff in the QFT looks, by my recollection, pretty much exactly what you've got on there.
Okay.
So,
yes,
they didn't think about DSR, of course. But they.
Can you check explicitly that unitarity is and even though you have no canonical structure which enforces it. So there is no constraint, it's automatically satisfied, unitarily, but it's optical theory.
Yes, matrix. Yeah, because the reason is that the asymptotic particles are not particles.
This is sufficient?
No, hold it. So think about cutting rules.
Yeah.
If you don't modify the external particles and you do modify the internal lines, then that's exactly where you might worry that there, that you would not have unitarity, because.
And that's the part that I've been making, then.
That's what I'm saying. You mess up the optics. You have a chance of messing up the optics.
Particles, of course, but you can get into trouble inside.
But, you know, I mean, the optical theorem presumably is modified at short length scales.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's.
Oh, yes, it would contaminate, I presume. If it's modified, you cannot recuperate it.
There might be all kind of different channels open to you, and you would mess up the brightly.
No, that's true. I mean, it certainly, you know.
It should be exactly satisfied.
You can't say anything.
Well, I mean, it's a matter of what it means to satisfy it, I guess.
No, but
I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt, but I gather you haven't looked at it.
I've looked at these things in all the examples that I have computed explicitly, and it wasn't a problem for the general thing.
But the optical theorem works out okay.
If you choose precisely e to the minus b squared, there's no extra analytic structure in your propagator because there's no extra bolt.
There's no additional channels or anything?
No additional channels, but that's very precisely.
That's an assumption.
So you're saying there is constraint, namely you have to have that kind of cutoff or else you'll screw things up. Is that right?
Precisely.
Okay, so there is a constraint.
Which is?
Well, the constraint is that you, if you want to modify it, you've got to have that, according to Conrad, that exponential.
If you just modify your propagator, right, roughly speaking, you don't want any new analytic structure. Right.
But look about the exponential damping factor that was introduced, e to the minus epsilon type.
Well, you're saying that's exactly what you
need. There's no poles.
But then there are
cuts.
Then there are other problems.
There are other problems, but that part. Yeah.
So do you mean it's sufficient? No violation of the optical theory?
I think that's okay because you're basically what happens in effective field theory is basically the same. And there you also choose a smooth cutoff function up to b squared, up to some energy scale. And all the theorems work precisely up to the scale. And when you go beyond the scale, you try to push it beyond m squared. That's when the optical theorem breaks down, but the interpretation is very well known. It's basically your effective field theory stops being valid, and you can create the new mass of particles that you have
raised out. Asymptotically satisfied or exactly satisfied to that scale?
So in effect, the field theory is asymptotically satisfied at the scale. Here, I don't know whether it's...
No, it is asymptotically satisfied.
Do you have a second?
Other questions? Thanks, everyone.